Father John A. Hardin, S.J., is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is a series of lectures given by Father Hardin on Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father Hardin first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, The Eightfold Path of Nirvana. Father Hardin.
We now want to take up the Eightfold Path of Buddha, which, as you know, is the method that he proposed to his followers for becoming delivered from suffering by finally ridding themselves of desire. In sequence, as we mentioned, each one is called right this and right that, beginning with understanding and ending with concentration. You'll find in different authors different translations of equivalent words. Usually you can identify and see that it's pretty much the same thing. First then, right understanding. Right understanding means, and you might almost say it corresponds to our Christian concept of faith. It means the acceptance of Buddha's tetralogy first. In other words, the existence of suffering, its origin in desire, the extinction of desire in nirvana, and the right method, which we are here considering. It also means that a disciple believes in demerit. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any particular point in going on. That is, in his terms, it is the destruction of any living being. So a person acquires demerit, which you might call sin, of any living being, stealing, unlawful sexual intercourse, lying, tale-bearing, harsh language, frivolous talk, ill will. The opposite to this Decalogue, and there are 10, by the way. Do you have your Decalogue there? No. Page 3, is the Decalogue there? No. Let's give you the Buddhist Decalogue. In other words, what are the 10 articles of the faith? In other words, what are the 10 things? The first is the acceptance of the four principal truths of Buddhism. But then, the object of belief is also in, call it sin, which would be, one, the destruction of any living being, two, stealing, third, unlawful sexual intercourse, fourth, lying, fifth, tale-bearing, sixth, harsh language, seventh, frivolous talk, eighth, avarice or covetousness, ninth, ill will, and tenth, having wrong views. And by wrong views, it would be having thoughts contrary to the Buddhist faith. So the destruction of any living being, stealing, unlawful sexual intercourse, lying, tale-bearing, harsh language, frivolous talk, covetousness, ill will, and wrong views. The opposite, then, to this Decalogue are good actions or meritorious actions. Or in general, the root of merit is a negative thing. It's the absence of greed, the absence of anger, and the absence of delusion, where delusion is always being deluded about the reality of things as Buddha explains them. You have then the object of the Buddhist faith expressed in the right understanding. Fundamentally, it would be then the acceptance on faith of his fourfold path, and the further acceptance on faith, and you don't go behind it. You don't find, for example, any ethical or moral system in Buddhism to explain why unlawful sexual intercourse is bad. It is. So two objects of faith. One, you might say, in the doctrinal order, and the other, the object of faith in the moral order. The second is right-mindedness. As you follow this, and by the way, there's profound wisdom in the way he approaches things and the way this thing is structured. Talk about a structured religion, sisters. Right-mindedness is to preserve one's thoughts free from lust, free from ill will, and free from cruelty. Now this, in general, he called the earthly right-mindedness. It yields worldly fruits and brings good results for the person here and now. But beyond this, he spoke also of an ultra-mundane, it's our vocabulary we're talking about, ultra-mundane right-mindedness. And out of which, if the person has been faithful in the first type, the second will arise. Namely, whatever thinking or reasoning the mind does by being turned away from the world and converted to the path which leads to nirvana. If there is anything which is true of Buddhism, as you go through, you will see the degree to which the follower becomes interiorized. Talk about the interior life. Where interior is the most metaphysical thing you've ever heard of. In other words, the mind must not only believe, which is number one, in Buddha's teachings, but must constantly reflect upon it to attain their nirvanic goal. So if the first, namely, right understanding, sets the principles, right-mindedness is the setting of the operations of the spirit to reflect upon and to deal with those principles. Buddhism is not gnosis. It is a very active thing. By the way, these eight steps have a very close relationship, and Buddhist texts explain how they're related, and there is very deep logic between them. The third is right speech. This avoids lying, tale-bearing, and the other demeritorious actions. Notice, always insofar as this now refers to the second stage. The first is the principles, without which nothing happens. Without them, you don't even begin to become a Buddhist. You start with stage number two, namely, where you begin to set your mind in the right direction. Here it is, the setting of one's speech. In other words, the care that demeritorious actions, or the accumulation of meritorious actions, will take place in the communication of thought. So first is the direction of thought. Now the communication of thoughts. But the person who practices it also avoids harsh language. So it's not merely that he will say the right things, but that he will also avoid saying the wrong things. Silence, as his follower said, is a very important part of religion. Indispensable. that person speaks such words as are gentle, I'm quoting now from one of his disciples, soothing to the ear, that's a new one, loving, going to the heart, courteous, pleasing, and agreeable to as many as possible, assuming you cannot be agreeable to everyone. Now just let me for a moment point out the relationship between 2 and 3. Number 3 cannot be kept, and each of the disciples points out, and the great masters of Buddhism say, you've got to work at each step, and the risk is, he said, to jump to step 3 or 4 before you have mastered steps number 1 or 2. In other words, that a person will, and this of course is also good gospel teaching, his speech will be as right as his mindedness is right. I don't know how many persons I've told in counseling whose speech has got them into trouble. And as I've discovered, in most cases, most family problems arise from the wrong kind of speech. I tell them, you don't know the first ABC, and of course I don't tell them I'm quoting Buddha. A is right understanding, B is right mindedness, C is the right kind of speech. You cannot practice C until you have mastered B, and it's a lifetime job thinking kindly about unlovable people. You will say the nastiest things, and you will say them on your deathbed unless you have first learned to master your mind. Buddha was a genius. Number 4, right action. Right action, and we're always keeping at the back of our minds the Buddha's Decalogue. It abstains from the same demeritorious conduct as right speech, with emphasis, and this, if we know anything about human nature, you would expect it, with emphasis on the avoidance of unlawful sexual relations. Here I quote from a modern Buddhist commentator, and he is quite satisfied if the believing Buddhist will abstain from this kind of unlawful sexual intercourse. Notice everything depends on what's unlawful. Sexual intercourse is, of course, very lawful, provided it is lawfully done. But what's lawful? I quote, unlawful sexual relations are those that are had with such persons as are still under the protection of father, mother, brother, sister, or relatives. In other words, with minors, with married women, with female convicts, and persons engaged to be married. Period. Unquote. When I read Fletcher, this will be a parenthesis. You know Joseph Fletcher. He symbolizes so much for me. But when he says that, did he talk about this? I think we mentioned this. When he says that Christianity is not normative in morality, that Christianity gives no new norms or standards of morality. It only gives you new motives, higher motives, for being moral. And he says with emphasis in the same context, there are no two standards, in other words, limitations on liberty or positive prescriptions, which are Christian, that are different from the non-Christian world. Poor Fletcher, he's dumb. He probably never read 10 lines of Buddhism. And among the very practical areas, and this deserves a long parenthesis, among the areas where Christianity is profoundly different And depending on my audience, I tell them, you don't have to believe it just because I'm one. In fact, that might be one reason they wouldn't want to become Christians. I'm not telling you to believe it. I'm just stating a fact. Christianity is different, mainly in its norms of morality. It tells people to do things which other religions don't tell them to do. It tells them not to do certain things which other religions tell them you may do. Then I further tell them, and with that, I pass on to something else. And the one area where Christianity is most painfully normative is in what do you do with your sexual appetite. And then I tell them, the only religion known to mankind in the history of religions, and I've said this in the presence of specialists in comparative religion, the only religion that even dares to set up norms of sexual morality which makes monogamy mandatory as a condition of salvation, and which makes possible for some people who have, as they believe, the grace to do it, even to abstain for a lifetime from sexual intercourse, is Christianity. Then I challenge them. Will you name one religious system that does this? Then I wait for a hand. There isn't any. It's good to know this. And good to know what happens to Christians when they become unchristian. They may wear a religious habit or a Roman color. They are no longer Christian in the deepest metaphysical sense of that word. Close parentheses. In the same way, and the next one we have under right action is right living. In other words, this is sometimes used as a synonym for right action, but it is somewhat different. It means that a person, and I'm quoting again from a Buddhist commentator, gets his livelihood by a right way of living, which may be earthly or ultra-mundane right living, depending on how high he has reached in his Buddhist endeavor. Now this, again, bears some emphasis. Each one of these, by the way, as you can imagine, is good for a Buddhist retreat, which they make, incidentally. Because just as right action, though of course it pertains to all the types of action, all the, in that whole tenfold span, yet in general, writers in Buddhist asceticism stress the sexual part, realizing how important and difficult it is for most people. Then they also bring out, and then they somewhat synonymize right action by calling it also right living. In other words, that a person makes a living in the right way, which means that, you know, he rises in whatever profession he is. He earns his daily bread. He builds a home and supports his family by means that are good. And then right living would be identified with the way in which a person works out his living. The next is right effort, number 5. I have them noted in your notes, and I'll just make a brief commentary. You notice what we are doing and what, or rather what Buddha is doing. We are following his Eightfold Path. And honestly, as I read these, or as I, even now, after having seen them so many times, I say to myself, if I could only sell this, minus, of course, all that nirvanic speculation, to my Christian friends. Because He is trying to, as you can see, ensure that people will not merely speculate about this. That was Hinduism, and he had enough of it. He wants action. But he knows that all the right-mindedness or all the speech and action by itself will not be achieved unless there is the right kind of effort. And the four efforts, and to realize that each person has in him the capacity for making this effort. So you want to have the right kind of thoughts. And if you have them, inevitably you will have the right kind of speech. From the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And you want to perform the right kind of actions. In other words, between 4 and 5 is a break in that something new enters the picture. This, in a way, represents the ideal. The first 4 represent the ideal. But now, how do you achieve that? You've got to first avoid the rising of evil thoughts or emotions. Now this can be a lifetime, in fact, can be, it is for everybody. I've met people, octogenarians, on whom this never dawned. That maybe, of course by that time, what can you do except tell them to pray? But who never realized that while the source of their wrong speech or wrong action is the wrong kind of thoughts on their minds, that maybe they have some control over what gets on their minds. When I talked about this to the priests of the, this is another one of those parentheses, but I think it's hopefully will bring out a meaning and the implication for us. Why study this stuff unless we can get some good out of it? I spoke on 2 occasions on the invitation of the bishop to the priests of the Lansing Diocese, one group in Lansing, the other group in Kalamazoo. And, well, there are so many things you can talk about. And without, of course, daring, I wouldn't breathe a syllable that some of Buddha's writings or thought were behind what I was saying. But I said one of the main problems facing the church in modern times as found, say, in the clergy, and I can say the same thing for religious, is there are some utterly lawless, irrational ideas on people's minds. They're saying things that have never been pronounced by priestly lips, except by those who have completely scuttled their faith. And they're doing things, insane things. So what happened? So I tell them, Father, do you know what happened? Those ideas didn't come from outside. People put them there. And some people don't have sense enough to know that you've got to be at least as careful, to put it minimally, as to what gets into the mind as you are about what gets into the stomach. And any person who thinks he can allow anything to get into the mind and yet will watch his diet is out of his mind. When I first said that, Bishop Green immediately, both Zaleski and Green were there, Bishop Green said, Father, say that again next time you speak. You see what I'm saying, sisters? So the first effort, therefore, is that a person avoids the rising of evil thoughts or emotions. And let's not say, I can't help it. Because a person has to ask himself, well, how come I've got these kind of thoughts? How come I have these feelings? And of course, feelings just follow on thought. I can't control them. Of course you can't. Maybe now. But maybe you can do something about getting other kind of thoughts. Or at least don't want to anticipate Buddha, at least avoiding that the evil thoughts will not be on your mind. What are you reading? But I like it. That's not the point. But everybody's reading it. That's no norm. Secondly, overcome them when evil thoughts arise. So what do you do when those evil thoughts come? Buddha would ask his followers. Don't let them sit there. Do something about them. But notice by that time, sisters, he's already gone through the first, second, and third stage, particularly the first two. He has become profoundly aware of what's going on in his mind. And talking to the Orientals, in general, even Christian Orientals, because this is part of their thinking. You've never met people who are more conscious of what's going on inside. And if there's anything that dichotomizes the East and the West, this is it. The East in general is profoundly conscious to a point where we think it's mad of what's going on inside the human spirit. And we seem to go out of our way, invent things to keep us from thinking of what's going on inside. I hope I'm whetting your appetite for more. Third, now this is still a new idea. Not satisfied with just avoiding the rising of evil thoughts or emotions by knowing what things stimulate those kinds of thoughts and emotions. For example, the kind of people that I meet. A couple, for example, have been keeping company for a year. They're on the verge of marriage. And yet, the girl tells me, I love him, but it seems we get into either an argument, or at least if I keep my mouth closed, that I feel disturbed and distressed. Well, I tell him, well, I tell her, things won't change after marriage. If he's the type that what he says bothers you, it's going to be hard, but take my word, better now than later. So it's not only that, but it's also developing the rise of thoughts or sentiments which are good. Life is too short, even by Buddhist standards. And as a consequence, that a person goes out of his way to find people, to come into contact, to hear words, or to cultivate the rise of thoughts, which will, in turn, give right-mindedness, right action, right speech. And finally, and this is not easy, thoughts, according to Buddha, are like seed. No thought should be sterile. But it all depends, of course, on what kind of thought you've got. And consequently, some thought you shouldn't even allow to enter the mind. And he says, be sure you do it quick, because thoughts take root very fast. They germinate. They are very fertile, prolific. And all they need is the soil of your mind. But once you've got thoughts, and of course by that time how much a person has done, once you've got thoughts that now your Buddhist faith has told you, and may I add in parenthesis, once our Christian faith tells us,
please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.